Hello and welcome to QSO. It's all about ham radio. And this week on QSO, Dennis Kidder, the PIO of the Associated Amateurs of Long Beach. Dennis talks with members of his group. They also tell us all about their club station aboard the Queen Mary. Also, Andy Karstarfen. He's with the Mesquite Amateur Radio Society in Mesquite, Texas. And they talk about some interesting things that their organization does, including ham radio in the park. All of this brought to you by the TW Antenna Company, Heil Sound, and Gigaparts. Coming up right here on QSO, the TW2010 is a most unique ham radio antenna. The TW2010 covers five bands, 10, 12, 15, 17, and 20 meters. The TW2010 is not just a small portable antenna that assembles in about 5 minutes. The TW2010 is a great DX antenna with a very low angle of radiation. How low is that takeoff angle, you may ask? How about 26 degrees? The TW2010, with its stealth quality black powder coating, tends to disappear in its surroundings. This is the perfect antenna if you live in an area where outside antennas are restricted. The TW2010 gives you the advantage of stealth and high performance at the same time. You simply must see this antenna. The TW2010 is a sleek, professional-looking antenna that's very economically priced. Go to twantennas.com. That's twantennas.com. And look for the Gordon West review of the TW2010 in this September issue of CQ Magazine. With me is Dennis Kidder. And Dennis is with the ARALB, Amateur Radio Association of Long Beach. Now, have I got that right?
Close enough. It's Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach.
Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach. See, I have to screw it up somehow. I can't ever get everything 100% right. So tell me a little
bit.
When I called a little earlier, we had made contact, but you're right in the middle of a club meeting. And tell me a little bit about that. You had a speaker tonight, and tell me a little bit about what you folks were doing at the club meeting.
Okay, well, this is our regular monthly meeting this evening. We meet first Friday of every month at 7 o'clock. And, of course, you caught me right at the beginning of the meeting. Our speaker tonight was Michael Schofield, N6OKG, and as I mentioned earlier, he was not really talking about something really having to do with ham radio, but really more to do with radio in general and frequency reuse. It was kind of an interesting topic as to how you geographically allocate frequencies to radio stations so they don't interfere with each other. So it's kind of an interesting topic.
Well,
everybody.
There's that, and there's the frequency allocation for not just the main channels, but also for the remote broadcast and studio transmitter links and all those related things. That turns into a very, very complex hodgepodge of, you know, trying to figure out, well, can we fit this in?
And Absolutely. And he was just scratching the surface of it tonight. You can't really cover a lot of it in an hour, but he made it very interesting. It was very graphical. You know, he's a visual oriented guy, so he had lots of really pretty pictures and really good. Did a great presentation for us. I think everybody enjoyed it tonight.
Well, what's really interesting, and I don't want to get too far off the subject, but what's really interesting is when you look into AM broadcast directional stations and how all that fits together on a map. In other words, folks drive by an AM directional, they see four towers, and of course most people don't realize why there are four towers and why the station is actually directing the signal in a specific direction. And at some point in time it all started out you know, where one station wanted to run 50,000 watts into their city of license, but they had to protect somebody to the west. So there came the first directional array. And from that point on, you know, and that's really interesting. If you can lay out a map and see all these patterns and frequencies, it's really complex.
And well, that's the thing that he was doing for us tonight for essentially AM broadcast and some of the aircraft. The problems associated with frequency allocations for aircraft communications, like towers and air traffic control, all that sort of thing. It's a fascinating topic. And one that he could probably have talked about all night long, for sure.
Well, now tell me a little bit about the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach. Tell me a little bit about how what is the size of your group, and how did y'all first get together, and tell me a little bit about yourselves.
I'm gonna turn the mic over to Nate and let him tell you about that.
Okay, why don't we go ahead and introduce him real quick and tell him what his call sign is here.
Nate Brightman, King 6, Oscar Sugar Charlie.
King 6, Oscar Sugar Charlie. Nate.
Oscar.
Nice to meet you. And why don't you fill us in a little bit about the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach.
Well, nice to meet you, Ted. We're quite a well-established organization. We've been in existence for over 79 years.
81.
And although we're a Long Beach club, we actually meet in the city of Signal Hill, which is where oil was discovered in California many years ago. And we have 175 members, and very interesting meetings because we generally have a speaker on a very interesting subject. Any questions I can answer for you?
Well, I was going to say, this group has been together for 79 years, and you said how large is the membership again?
About 150 people.
Well, now that's a large club. It's been around for a long time. What do you think this has built the success of this amateur radio group?
Well, probably the fact that we have very interesting activities. And our most interesting one and, well, most famous one is that we have our club station, which is W6 Radio Operator, located on the Queen Mary in the Long Beach Harbor. And we have volunteers that operate that station during the week. And not only do we have Long Beach members operated, but the station is open for operation by any licensed amateurs, regardless of age.
So you're operating aboard the Queen Mary with your club station. Now that is very, very unique. How did you come about setting this up?
Well, actually, when the ship came over and the station, ship's radio station, was demolished and a shop's put in its place, I convinced the city of Long Beach to rebuild the radio room and operate it as an amateur radio station. It resembles the original room. And we have 85 volunteers that operate the station. Each one works a minimum of 4 hours once a month. And although it's very interesting, some of the people that operate the station, since it's open to all operators, we have one man that lives in the city of Reseda. Reseda is probably about 50 miles from Long Beach. And he comes in and operates about 3 days a week because he enjoys it so much instead of just operating once a month. We have another man who is works at JPL as an astronomer, and he lives a 200-mile round trip for he and his wife to come down and operate the station. So it's a lot of fun, and besides having a lot of fun talking to amateurs all around the world, we have a door that's kept open, and you get to talk to very many interesting people who visit the ship from all over the world.
Well, I can just imagine that is such a unique experience. And then by the same token, you're introducing an awful lot of folks to ham radio that normally would never get exposed to it. How many people do you think that you folks actually have a chance to see or get acquainted with or expose ham radio to? How many folks do you think that come by in a month that actually see you folks operate there?
Well, let me put it this way: going way back to where one time Howard Hughes, Bruce goose was on exhibit next to the Queen Mary. And the year that he was there, we had 1 million visitors, and most of them got to come by the station. We have hundreds coming by all the time. So it's we really get a lot of publicity for ham radio and talk to the people, not just about ham radio, about the wonderful city of Long Beach.
Well, that's interesting. So you actually pioneered this idea. In other words, you were the one that actually went to the city fathers and said, we need to rebuild the radio room on the Queen Mary, and we need to put an amateur radio station in here.
That's right. Actually, it started before that when I got permission from the British government and got a license to have one of our members operate a radio station on the Queen Mary on her last voyage from England to Long Beach. And they issued a special license for called a GB5QM, George 5, George Baker 5, Queen Mary. And we after the ship came in, then we opened the one on the ship a few years later, and it's probably the best-known amateur radio station in the world right now.
Now, the call sign for the club station, again, for folks listening, why don't we go ahead and give them the call sign so they can listen for this call?
A W6 radio operator.
What a great call. W6 radio operator, and that's the club that's aboard the Queen Mary. And, of course, that's the Association of Amateur Radio Operators in Long Beach. And I'm talking right now to Nate. We're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back right after this.
We want to invite you to check out the website at www.tedrandall.com. That's www.tedrandall.com. All the programs and shows that you hear right here on QSO are available on the website for download as podcasts. We invite you to check them out and browse the site and find out interesting things at www.tedrandall.com.
Well, our guest is Dennis Kidder. He is with the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach. We've been talking to Nate, and this gentleman here, very, very fascinating, is the fellow who really pioneered this thing with the radio amateur station and the rebuilding of the radio room on the Queen Mary. And they're operating on there as is it W6RO or K6RO?
That's correct.
Okay, it's W6RO, W6 radio operator. And if you hear that call sign on the air, you know that that's coming from the Queen Mary, and that's a great contact. Well, is there anything else that's unique about this that you'd like to share with our radio listeners?
Yes, particularly about ham radio. As you know, we recently had an earthquake in Long Beach, a very mild one. But when it happened, all the cell phones went out of service and the telephones went out of service, but amateur radio did not go out of service. In any emergency situation, the only reliable method of communication is via amateur radio. We proved that when they had the big earthquake in Mexico at W6RO aboard the Queen Mary. We were picking up messages from the amateur radio operators in Mexico and relaying them to relatives all over the United States from the Queen Mary.
So this last earthquake that came on, which was, what did they say? That was a 5.6 or something along that line, or somewhere in the vicinity of 5?
Yeah, 5.6.
Okay.
5.4.
5.4 on the Richter scale. Okay. Now, were you around? Did you feel the quake where you were at?
Oh, yes.
Oh, yeah.
We all felt the quake, but it was very mild compared to some that we've had in the past.
Well, the reason why I ask is sometimes in earthquakes, I've talked to folks and said, well, the earthquake, there was an earthquake, but for some reason I didn't feel it. I've talked to other folks that say, oh, my goodness, it was unbelievable. You know, so I guess maybe it depends on what you're doing and where you're at. I've never been through an earthquake, so I don't know. Now, you say your cell phones went completely dead.
That's right. All the cell phone towers, try to call relatives. And, of course, the first thing people do is get on the telephone, either cell phone or landline, and that just jams up all the circuits, so nobody gets through.
I've noticed where I'm at here, we just had a bad snowstorm one time. Just a really, really bad snowstorm. And, of course, folks in our area here of Tennessee, they're just not used to that. And it was really strange because you could not use a cell phone. Cell phones were useless. They just absolutely wouldn't operate. So I can imagine, I can't imagine, in an earthquake, especially in a high-populated area like where you're at, where the cell phone towers, you would have to have massive overloads of communication because everyone's trying to call everyone. Tell me a little bit about what it's like to go through that, because and especially having amateur radio at your side.
Well, it's very interesting. I'm very active in Red Cross Disaster Services. And during the big Northridge earthquake, we opened a shelter up there, and communication between shelters was via amateur radio. And Red Cross workers generally work a 12-hour shift. And in that particular case, because there were so many shelters open, we worked an 18-hour shift before we could get relief. But amateur radio is very closely tied with the Red Cross. At the local Red Cross chapter, we do have an amateur radio station there also.
Well, you know, it's good to hear these things. And for folks that are just tuning in, if you're a shortwave listener and you haven't really been exposed to ARES and a few of the other amateur radio like RACES and Army Mars and things like that, the result of amateur radio in a disaster is short of fantastic. I mean, what can happen? Now, tell the folks a little bit about the types of communication that you were carrying on and the types of communication that you do.
Well, of course, the biggest amount of traffic that we carry is from, like, Red Cross chapters to the shelters, and then also we take what we call health and welfare messages. We take a message from a disaster area and transmit those messages to relatives throughout the United States. And just about all the radio clubs in the United States are active in there. Just in June, for example, we had what we call Field Day. This is an exercise where amateurs operate from power generators, batteries, from a field. We have no, we cannot operate from buildings or any source other than temporary. And we practice by making contacts with other radio club field stations. And now we get broken into the message handling system so that we can, in a really big emergency, we're familiar with the correct operation of transmitting messages.
Now, the types of messages you get, where would they tell us a little bit? Now, you're working with the Red Cross, and I would assume also that you're working with some other, you know, some other organizations beside the Red Cross. I know a lot of times the Salvation Army is involved. There's other people that are involved in these disasters. But talk about where do the messages originate, and then where do you folks get them to?
Well, the messages originate from whoever happens to be in the disaster area, and they go to the relatives of the people that are in that area, because there's no way, as we say, for information to get to relatives except via amateur radio, particularly in a situation where the radio, whatever radio communications available, are generally taken over by emergency services of the cities or by the news media. They monopolize the normal methods of communication.
We're talking right now with Nate Brightman, and I've got your name correct, don't I?
That's correct.
Okay. Call sign is K6 Ocean Sierra Charlie. And
that's correct.
And he is with the Association or Associated Amateur Radio Operators of Long Beach. I hope I've got this right. But you folks are, this is phenomenal. If you go on to Google, if you just go to Google and you put in the call sign, W6RO, Whiskey 6 Radio Operator, this website comes up and you can see pictures of the Queen Mary, and you'll see a picture of Nate sitting in front of, now I see a picture of you here. Is this the radio room in the Queen Mary, or is that your home shack? What are we looking at?
That's the Queen Mary. That's the Queen Mary.
Okay, I was hoping that wasn't your bedroom, because if it was, I was going to be real jealous.
Right, you are.
He doesn't want to see my radio room.
Well, this is really interesting. Now, of course, you folks are involved. Being in Long Beach, of course, you're going to have earthquakes. You're going to have that. I suppose you don't have the weather emergencies there. Like, for example, you probably don't have the tornadic activity that we have here. The tornadoes that come ripping through here at absolutely sometimes no notice at all. And where you have a whole city just, you know, blown to the ground. And
our other big threat out here in Southern California, of course, is the wildfires. We have a lot of dry brush. I mean, it is a desert out here, and we have a lot of dry brush around the areas, and we get some wildfires going in here, and that can tend to be a large disaster as well. So, as you say, we really don't have the weather problems out here, but we do have, you know, amongst the earthquakes, we do get the occasional wildfires. We've had some big ones in California this year. It's been particularly rough.
All I know,
go ahead.
Yeah, we've seen an awful lot of that. Go ahead.
A few years ago for the Red Cross, I did a damage assessment of the fire damage in the Santa Monica Mountains. And that's like going into a moonscape. I mean, with all the ash spread around, you feel like you're in actually another world.
Well, we had heard an awful lot about the fires, you know, and, you know, I guess the thing of it is that you've got a situation where normal communications is just not set up to handle the amount of overload that it gets. In other words, there's such an increase in activity that normal communications can't handle it. So, therefore, nothing works. I mean, I've seen this happen where just, you know, all of a sudden the cell phones aren't working. If you have a landline, you can't get a dial tone. I mean, sometimes if you sit long enough, you'll wind up getting the dial tone. But those are the things that happen. And, of course, people have questions. I mean, you have massive numbers of people that are wondering, what's going on? You know, and of course, they've got radio and TV on. But still in all, if they're wanting to find out a specific thing. And, another thing, too, do you not also get traffic from, say, for example, like the Red Cross, where they're trying to get point-to-point communication between two, like, say, for example, two hospitals, where they're trying to get word from one to the other? Do y'all get involved in things like that?
Interesting that you'd bring that topic up. I have to put in a plug for the other group that I belong to. Here in, you know, this is Los Angeles County where the club is here, but I actually live in the next county, Orange County, to the south. We have a group down there, which you actually may have heard of before. It's the Orange County Hospital Disaster Support Communication System. This is an ARES group. I act as an assistant emergency coordinator in that group. And our charter, our specific mission is to support the hospitals in Orange County and basically provide communications backup to services that are critical to patient care. And we recognize that hospitals are an extremely important organ in any community, and they do require backup communications, and probably more often than people would care to know about. Things like you're talking about telephone overloads during an earthquake. A hospital can be in a disaster all by itself. Without an earthquake, they can have a telephone switch go down, and a hospital without telephone communications really has a communications disaster. So we'll put a group of hams, and they're trained. These are trained amateurs. We actually train with the with our staff and with the emergency medical services staff in the county, and we will put a team of hams into a facility or into multiple facilities and handle traffic either between the hospital and another hospital or the hospital in the county, hospital and city races groups and things like that. So it's a, that's a really incredible organization that, that we have a number of members actually in Long Beach Club here that belong to the HDSCS. That's been around, I'm just trying to think of how many years that group has been in existence. That one's been out there for a long time. I think we just celebrated our 26th year as an active ARES group.
Well, that's impressive, and I'm glad you're sharing that with us. We're going to take a quick break, though, and we'll be right back. Our guest is Dennis Kidder, and we've also been talking to Nate Brightman. These fellows are with the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach that has W6RO on the Queen Mary. And we'll be back. We'll talk to them in just a few minutes. The TW2010 is a most unique ham radio antenna. The TW2010 covers five bands, 10, 12, 15, 17, and 20 meters. The TW2010 is not just a small portable antenna that assembles in about 5 minutes. The TW2010 is a great DX antenna with a very low angle of radiation. How low is that takeoff angle, you may ask? How about 26 degrees? The TW2010, with its stealth-quality black powder coating, tends to disappear in its surroundings. This is the perfect antenna if you live in an area where outside antennas are restricted. The TW2010 gives you the advantage of stealth and high performance at the same time. You simply must see this antenna. The TW2010 is a sleek, professional-looking antenna that's very economically priced. Go to twantennas.com. That's twantennas.com. And look for the Gordon West review of the TW2010 in this September issue of CQ Magazine. Our guest is Dennis Kidder, and he is with the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach. They have W6RO on the Queen Mary. That's their, that is their club station operating on the Queen Mary. This is kind of an idea that was pioneered years ago by Nate Brightman, and we've been talking to him just a little bit. This has been a very, very interesting QSO so far. And, Dennis, you were talking about somebody else in the room there with you. You're trying to get this fella on the air. Why don't you go ahead and introduce him?
Well, I've got John Rogers, KF6TTR. He's a former president of the club and a former officer. He's served on our board many times. And he's actually the assistant manager of W6RO. And he's been sitting here patiently in the back seat, so I'm going to get him to speak up.
Well, why don't you tell us an interesting story or talk a little bit about the association. We'd love to hear from you, John.
Okay, well, Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach started in May of 1927. That makes us 81 years old. We've been on board the ocean liner Queen Mary now for 30 years almost. It's coming up. And we have a lot of, amateur radio today that plays in the room next to us 24 hours a day. We've been playing that ever since it started.
How many have you worn out?
We've worn out four DVD players. It's still going, running real good.
That's for the benefit of the tourists.
Yeah.
Right. And as you know, as amateur radio operators, to prove that we talk to one another, we send QSL cards back and forth. It's a postcard with the nice pictures on it and all the information, what frequency and what time, the date. And we send these back and forth to one another. And we have a very nice one that we send out. If they send one to us, we send back to them.
Well, now let me ask you a question. Can we look for a specific frequency that you folks tend to operate on when you've got... when you've got the station on, when you're on this W6RO, is there any particular place that folks can look for you?
Well, if you go on 28.380, that's the 1010 group. We use that station quite a bit at frequency. If you go on, that's 10 meter. On 20 meter, go to 14.285. You'll find us there quite a bit, and also 235. You can go on 40 meter and catch us on 7.235. 80 meter, you can catch us on 3., I forget. 235. Try that one.
Well, that won't work.
That won't work either.
I'm not sure what the where they hang out on 80 meters.
Well, anywhere
on 80 meters.
What's interesting, Ted, is that we don't require our operators to work any special frequencies. Every operator comes up there, runs the station just as he would his home station. And that's what makes it interesting, because they feel perfectly at home when they're aboard the Queen Mary.
Well, you know, I guess what I was thinking is that there are folks that probably would love to get a QSL card, so they'd love to work the station. So in my way of thinking, I was thinking, well, there may be some place that they kind of hang out at a little bit, you know. But now, are there special days that you have, like, for example, where W6RO operates as a commemorative station or a particular day or time when you would be more or less hanging out on one frequency there?
Well, we just recently had the museum ships weekend.
Yes.
The
station on the Queen Mary is the first time that an amateur radio station was established on a museum ship. And since that time, museum ships from all over the country, all over the world actually, have set up stations on the ships of their country. And every year they have what's called Museum Ship Weekend, where all the stations try to contact each other, stations that are located on museum ships.
Well, I know a friend of mine that was on one weekend, and he said, my goodness, he said, I work so many ships, you know. And I said, well, there must be a ship's day or something going on here. So that explains that. He was really tickled because he had talked to all these different ships, you know, in one weekend, and he said it was just really incredible. But we'll have to have folks looking for the call sign, W6RO, and so that they can get on and make contact. And, of course, most important, it'd be interesting for folks when they go on vacation to include a trip out to the Queen Mary and be able to see the ship. I'm sure the ship itself is an incredible tour, and to add amateur radio to it is just the icing on the cake. So that would be a real great thing. That's something I would really love to see. I'd like to come out and take a look at that.
If tourists who come to visit the Queen Mary and come by the radio room there, W6RO, if they have a digital camera with them or any kind of camera, we invite them to come in and sit at one of our radio positions, and we'll use their camera and take their picture so they can have as a souvenir of their visit.
You know, and for those that may not know, and I'm not real familiar with the story behind the Queen Mary, but maybe either Nate or John there, maybe one of you two could kind of give folks, especially younger people that are just tuned in, give us a little background on the Queen Mary. What makes this ship so special?
Well, what makes the ship so special is the fact that it has carried so many important people. And during World War II, it was a troop ship and carried thousands of GIs back and forth, and at the end of the war, carried all the war brides and their children from England to the United States. But there's one interesting thing about the Queen Mary. I've been on cruise ships, and you don't get the nostalgic feeling on a modern cruise ship as when you get when you walk the halls of the Queen Mary. There's something a mystic feeling about it. When you walk along, people ask me if there's ghosts on the Queen Mary, and some people say there are. I can't say for sure there are, but I know when I walk on the sun deck, many times I'll see nobody on the deck, and still I feel like I'm not alone, and I will suddenly walk over the rail and look shoreward. Now, I've done that hundreds of times, and why I do it, I don't know.
Maybe there is a ghost that's encouraging me to go take another look.
Well, you know, I've heard stories. Matter of fact, I think I even saw a television special of some sort.
Yep.
And they were talking about the Queen Mary being a haunted ship, you know. And, of course, that always makes things even more interesting, you know. So, you know, I'm wondering if you're ever, have you ever have you ever been in the radio room at night when the lights were out all by yourself? Have you ever been in a play in there like that?
Well, of course, we have many operators who come in and operate during the night. Once a person is indoctrinated as a radio operator on the Queen Mary, they are permitted to get the key to the radio room from security anytime they want to come aboard, and people who can't come during the day, they will come in the evening or late at night and operate, because from here late at night is the best time to talk to places like Australia, New Zealand, and Japan.
John, you've had some ghostly experiences aboard the Queen.
Well, I have a picture that I took in one of the doorways there on one of my little box cameras, and when they developed it, you can see outline and all white, like someone standing there. And I didn't see that when I was looking through the camera, but that's what came out on the film.
Well, you know, that happens frequently. You hear these stories of folks that go, they take a picture, and then later when the picture's developed, there's an image in the picture that was not there when they took it. There's an extra person or an outline of someone. Now, where was this picture taken at?
Right in front of the wireless room in the arch to the left if you're looking out of the wireless room.
And who took the picture?
I did.
You took it, okay. So you know there was no funny business going on when you took the picture.
And it's not a...
like a reflection.
It's not an overprint either.
Yeah.
It was the last picture in the camera.
John doesn't know how to use Photoshop, so we can believe him.
Okay. Well, I was going to say, if you have a chance, what you need to do is email me that picture, and we'll put it up on the website. That'll be a good point of interest. Folks can come up and look. Now, the outline, what you're seeing there, what is it that you're, can you make it out very well, or what does it look like?
Looks like a person standing there.
Very interesting. Well, that goes kind of hand-in-hand with some of the stories, of course, with the history that the Queen Mary, when was the ship built? What year was the Queen Mary actually built or christened?
The Queen Mary was started in 1930, and then there was a time when it sat for a couple of years collecting rust because of the Great Depression in England. And then in 1934, they had launched her and called her Queen Mary. Before that, she was Job 534. In 1936, after they put all the, now they're antiques, but and they decorated the ship, and they made its first voyage in 1936, made its last voyage December 9th, 1967, when it came into Long Beach. It's 1,001st voyage.
Now, that's just really incredible. With us right now is Dennis Kidder, along with Nate Brightman and John Rogers, all with the Associated Amateurs of Long Beach. And we'll be back, and we'll talk a little bit more with him right after this.
You might want to know, why is it that we talk about Heil microphones so much, or why do I need a Heil microphone? Here's Bob Heil talking about Heil microphones.
Let's talk microphones for a second. When you're in a situation like an emergency, a disaster field day, and you really want to punch through, and you want something that's going to just cut through the mustard, so to speak, what's a good microphone to do that?
Well, we're talking about amateur radio. And, of course, the FCC dictates the fact that we'll be about 3 KCs wide, so you don't have a lot of bandwidth. Well, what we do is the microphone for that choice is a microphone that we tailor with an it actually has a labyrinth inside it, Ted. It's an amazing little piece that I designed back in 1982. And this thing tunes 10 dB spike at about 2,500 cycles. I mean, it's just in your face. Not pretty sounding, but it cuts right through, rolls everything off under 600 cycles, everything off of it about 5K with this great big spike right in the middle of the human voice where we need to know, what did you say, an F or an S, a P or a B, to get that articulation. Because when we're out in the emergencies or with her just running a contest with a lot of noise and there's a lot of stations, that guy's going to be heard first because all of his power is going to be right where the human ear wants to hear those important syllables. And that's what we've done for this industry, is create microphones that do that. We also have, of course, as you well know, microphones that work on the performance level. But for ham radio, it's a whole different ballgame because we're only dealing with 2.5 to 3 KC wide bandwidth that the FCC will dictate to us. But the important thing is to get articulation through. And then we build that in microphones that you can hold in your hand, or we build it in headsets that you can wear and have hands-free, that kind of thing.
Well, now, of all the Heil models, which one is the most optimum for that sort of thing? Which one would you, if you were going to pick one today to operate field day, what would you pick?
Well, that, we build a number of things. That element is called an HC4, a Heil cartridge 4. That's got that big spike in it. And that HC4 we build in a headset, our ProSet 4. We build it in a microphone, which is the HM10 that has both elements in it, both that HC4 and the HC5, which is a real smooth reg-2 type thing. And we have it in our Goldmine, the GM4, and all of those products have the HC4 for ultimate communications. And then they have another element that you can switch in for when you're just talking to your buddies and you don't need all that that spike and that articulate sound to cut through noise and things. But we make the HC4 into a lot of different products because we make various headsets and microphones, and the HC4 is the one to do that with.
Of all the Heil mics, which ones do you find the HC4 cartridge in?
Well, we have the HM10, our Goldmine GM4. Those are both microphones. In fact, the GM4 looks like our PR20 that you see on the stages, but has a push-to-talk switch in it, and it has both of these elements. It has the wideband element and the HC4. Then we also have the Handy Mic, and the Handy Mic 4, it's only 4 inches long. It has this element in it, and that's what we use for a hand mic. It's just wonderful for communications for ham radio.
Before you make your next selection for a microphone for your new ham rig or your old ham rig, remember Heil Sound. That's heilsound.com. Or you can find them on our website at tedrandall, tedrandall.com. And remember, Heil is spelled H-E-I-L. That's H-E-I-L. HeilSound.com. We're talking to the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach, and their club station, W6RO, is on the Queen Mary. And with us is Dennis Kidder, along with Nate Brightman and John Rogers. And while we were taking our break, Dennis said that John has a few ghost stories that he likes to tell. So I would like to hear some of these. Enlighten us. These are always interesting things to listen to.
Well, one night I was walking around the decks with a compass, and I'd stop in one place and look at it, and I'd keep walking. This large security guard came up to me, and it's 10:30 at night. He says, "What are you doing?" I says, "I'm looking for ghosts." And he backs up and looks at me like I'm crazy, you know. I says, "Come here." And I had the compass. I step one step forward, and the compass does a 360-degree turn. I step one step backwards, and it does 360 the other way. I said, "See, that's a ghost portal." And he just looked at me and walked away. We had a lot of fun. There's a paranormal on board the ship there, and he says there's 642 ghosts on board. Well,
paranormal tour.
Yeah, the paranormal does this. And it's quite a few different tours that they take, plus the one that the Queen has. But people come to the wireless room and they ask me about the ghost. I tell them, "Well, up here on the sports deck, the walls are white, and you see ghosts in black and white. And, you know, trying to read the lips of a ghost against a white wall is really hard." So they asked, well, have you seen any ghosts? I said, well, you see things up here that, you know, you're not quite sure what it is. What I understand is we have 5 men, 4 women, 3 children, and 3 dogs. And the dog kennels were behind us many years ago. Is that we're up on the sports deck, and the wireless room used to be downstairs where the on the promenade deck where the Queen Shell Castle is. That's in the middle of the ship there. And off to the starboard side of the ladies' restroom, that was the transmitter room. And there's other places that they had during the war, and it was called the Gray Ghost from 1940 to 1947. Talking about age of things, Nate Brightman, let you know, is 90 years old. And
yeah, just celebrated your 90th.
He's going to haunt the ship when he leaves.
Well, congratulations, Nate. That's pretty impressive. And I the ghost stories are fascinating. The thing that I guess if you're saying this paranormal said there was how many ghosts on board this ship?
He says 642. Well, probably 380 of those or more was when the Queen Mary ran over the Kearsage, I think it was called. It was a British light cruiser during the war, and they couldn't tell anybody that they hit it. Because no one was supposed to know where the Queen was. And one of the other ships noticed it and came over and saved a few of the people, but most of them perished. The ship went down in 2.5 minutes, and that's where a lot of the ghosts come from. That people die on board the ship when they're on cruises. They fall downstairs, some of the crew members. The most famous is John Petter, a 19-year-old young man that got crushed between door 13. Now, I want to know if someone put him there, or if he tripped and fell, or if he was horse playing. But I've never been able to talk to him yet.
Well, you know, you kind of wonder. Your mind goes down that road a little bit, especially if you've seen the movie Frequency at all.
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Well, you know, you kind of wonder. You really do. I mean, there's so little we understand and know about so many things, and there's things that tend to defy the laws of physics. So a lot of what we know is not necessarily the way things are, you know. So you just don't know. You don't want to believe everything, but you also don't want to doubt everything either. And all of this makes a real interesting conversation. But now let me ask this question. With your amateur radio group, of course you have the station on the Queen Mary and you do all these wonderful things. Tell me a little bit more. What else is the Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach involved in? What other activities do you do? What do you have going on?
How about the marathon?
We have four things that we do every year up here at Signal Hill. And by doing these, we get to use the community center free, which saves the club $365 a month.
Yeah.
These four activities, one of them is breakfast with Santa during Christmas. We have the Halloween party that we do here. We have the Easter egg hunt, the extravaganza. And we have one that we do at one of the parks. It's just like a little fair. And we help them with the setting up or the games or whatever they need us our help for. And we always bring our HTs with us just in case we need to communicate back and forth. So,
yeah. One of the activities that the club's been involved in, actually, there's an ARES races group here in Long Beach that a lot of our club members are involved with. But one of the big activities here in Long Beach is the Long Beach Marathon. It's been going on for a number of years down there. We provide health and welfare traffic communications for that particular event. That's a pretty well-known event around the country, if not the world. We get some international runners out here, so it's a big marathon. And we've, as a club, have participated in that for many years.
I think you'd be very surprised if you saw the inside of Dennis's car. We have a set up of radios in here. We have a few radios. And this car is not only capable of doing local communications, but worldwide.
Well, what all do you have in there, Dennis? Tell us a little bit about this automobile.
Oh, I think Nate's exaggerating. Well, I've got a pretty nice mobile setup. I'm pretty proud of it. From HF to microwave. In fact, that's one of my other interests is microwave. But we do. I've got an HF radio, a Yaesu FT-857. Hang out mostly on 40 meters mobile with that. 742 Kenwood, and the Kenwood D700, which is their APRS radio. So I actually have an APRS station here in the truck. And there's other radios that get put in here periodically. We do we like to do VHF contesting. So we'll toss a couple of other radios and put a stack of antennas on the roof and go out and do some roving. And we also toss microwave radios in here. I spend a lot of time on 10 gigahertz and 24 gigahertz, so that gets thrown in here periodically. So that's the rolling antenna farm.
You know, John could tell you some interesting things about how we work with the Boy Scouts, how we teach them, give them a sampling of Morse code. Go ahead, John, tell them about what we do on the...
Well, on the Queen, we bring them down, and they need to visit an amateur radio station. That's part of their radio merit badge. And then we tell them about simplex and repeaters and about Morse code. We let them send their call sign and our call sign and Morse code on the practice area.
Tell them about the park.
And then every year we have Scoutorama at one of our local parks here, and we set up a booth for the kids to talk on amateur radio down to the Queen Mary. We have them do CW there, also their name, and that's part of it, explain amateur radio to them. And we have a fox hunt that they go on, and that's with Joe Mel. He's
a K6OV,
K0OV, and he takes them on a fox hunt there in the park.
Tell them what a fox hunt is.
It's a T-hunt where they hide transmitters, and you go out with receivers and try to find where the transmitter is.
Joe's the National ARDF coordinator for the ARRL. Yeah.
And his wife sets up a booth there for
hospital
disaster communications and shows them how to take messages and send messages. And we work quite a bit with the Boy Scouts. We have quite a few Boy Scout leaders in our group. We have what they call JOTA, Jamboree on the Air. We do that. I think it's in October. It's coming up. Where the scouts go up on the mountain peaks and they transmit with amateur radio and also with mirrors. And we kind of help in that from the Queen. And this year we're supposed to set up at one of the parks, one of they're talking about. So we get a lot of activity with the Boy Scouts.
Well, that's wonderful that you folks are involved in that. Let me ask you this: what do you, if apart from the Queen Mary, okay, you've got a great group there. What do you think it is? What are the elements that holds the group together and continues to produce success and draws more people in? What do you attribute that to?
Well, actually, you know, in order to get a amateur radio license, up until last year, you were required to be able to send and receive Morse code. And that's been eliminated now, but there's still a written examination that you must take to pass it. And you might say that after you go through that, you have sort of a kinship with everybody else that has done it, and you get involved in amateur radio communications. You get to meet other hams. You get to discuss developments in the amateur radio and amateur radio equipment and get involved in all these various projects. And that's what keeps it so interesting. There's always something to do in amateur radio. It's not like you just go to a meeting and sit there and listen to a lecture, because the meeting is merely the nucleus of activities.
Yeah, I was going to add that this is a very social club. It kind of maybe sets it apart from other clubs in that some clubs have, other clubs I belong to, I do belong to other radio clubs. Some of them are technical clubs. We're builders, operators, what have you. This club is more of a social club. It is a special service club. That's true. We are a special service club. But there is a social element to this. I mean, we just like each other, you know. We like hanging out. folks like getting together. We've got a club activity coming up in a couple of weeks as we're having a barbecue. So the social events tend to bind us together as well, and a lot of those social events are outside of ham radio. So, you know, there's that aspect of it. It is an active club. I will, you know, like we say, we've got quite a large membership. The club is very healthy financially and with our membership. And in an area where there are actually quite a few radio clubs around here, we're probably one of the larger ones in the area.
We're certainly the oldest.
Certainly the old. Well, I don't know. URAC may be a little older than we are. I don't know.
They started in January, according to them, of 1927. But their club has three different names.
Yeah.
So ours is one.
It's been one. Yeah, interesting note about the origins of our club. It started as a social club. It was a bunch of guys getting together in the park. And
between 1923 and 1927 at Recreation Park.
Yeah, and then in 1927 decided to formalize it and make it into an association.
All right.
So it started out as a bunch of hams that got together socially in the park, and it evolved into the club that we have today.
The Associated Radio Amateurs of Long Beach. That's the folks that we're talking to right now. We're talking to Dennis Kidder, Nate Brightman, John Rogers. Thank you so much for joining me.
Well, if you come out to California, be sure to give us advance notice so we can give you a good tour of the Queen Mary.
I'll definitely do that. Thank you guys so much. It's been a pleasure.
I'm